everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
You betcha. And this is episode number 78. And we're going to talk about Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I love this movie.
Me too.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's deceptively simple seeming, but there's a lot going on.
There is. Yeah. I agree with you. First of all, to get this out of the way, did you see it in 3D?
I did. I had a friend who recommended this was the time to go see the 3D IMAX version. And I don't think it really added anything for me except a certain element of motion sickness.
Yeah, well, I felt the same. I also saw it in 3D when I first saw it, but it was not IMAX. So, and again, you know, this being the ultimate 3D movie, I again felt like it added nothing. And not only that, but, you know, it makes the screen dimmer. I mean, there's a list of my complaints. But again, though I did not hate it, I thought that it added nothing.
My husband felt the same way. We walked out and said, well, we paid for that as an experiment, but we think on a big screen it would have been the same. Although I feel that they had compensated adequately for the dimness. It wasn't as bad as I've seen on most of them. And I think that's why James Cameron was providing glowing words about it too, which I understand Avatar did the same thing. It didn't really darken it down. I don't know because I didn't see it. But.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to mention that because it's one of my bugaboos. I just don't understand how it's out there.
Me too. I resist it always.
I always pick the other one. And I may have said this in a previous podcast, but I remember going to see the Avengers. And the line that I was in for that was for the non-3D. And the line was out the door. And the 3D version, people were walking in.
Yeah.
So I think that we're in the majority, but I'm not positive.
Well, I know. You kind of wonder. Well, I think they don't all come out in 3D, right?
So yeah.
That's kind of a sign, too.
Right. Yeah.
But
anyway. So anyway, yeah, Gravity, the movie.
Yes.
So I don't know. Do we need to give a synopsis?
Well, for one thing, I would say, what do you say? Peter Travers said when he's asked that question, what was he going to say? Because I looked up a bunch of movie. He says, if anyone asks me what Gravity is about, I'll tell them it's a tense adventure about a space mission gone wrong. But once they've seen and absorbed the movie, they'll know the truth.
Hmm. Well,
and it's a thriller adventure sort of a movie. Of two astronauts who are fixing the Hubble telescope or doing something. And a bunch of space debris comes around and they are left on their own. And can they survive and get back to Earth with no shuttle left workable?
Yeah. And we should mention the beauty of this movie. that's the thing that I think of and probably will think of, you know, when it's mentioned to me. You know, in the future is just how beautiful it is. It's a stunningly cinematic movie.
Yes. And some of these long shots that are taken, the first sequence is 13 minutes long, unbroken. And a lot of it, the planet itself is the unattainable star or, you know, goal that's in the background always. And when we were watching it, my husband kept leaning over going, look, there's the Nile. Look, there's... You know, he was spotting all this stuff.
Wow.
And
yeah, that'd be fun to be in space with your husband.
It was, because I felt like I was there.
Yeah, and that's another thing about it. I think that cinematography is part of it. But there was a really striking feeling of being there in this movie that I don't think I've gotten in other space movies. Maybe Apollo 13, thought Apollo 13 was really good, but there was just something about this one that really felt real.
I think for me, what this one did, because I'll never get to go into outer space, and now you feel like you know what it would be like. It's the closest I'm going to get. Because Sandra Bullock is the neophyte scientist. Well, she's not a neophyte scientist, but she's a neophyte astronaut. She's trained for 6 months to be able to go up into outer space and do her experiment. And so when this disaster happens, she's us. She's the one where he's going, okay, get ready to grab anything you can when we get up to this space station, and you're seeing her, and you're, even though you know it's the first 5 minutes of the movie, I guess she's going to live. So, but still, you're leaning sideways, no, go sideways, go sideways. And you see her bouncing off of stuff and unable to grab things. And so you get that real feeling of what it's like moving around up there. And everything I read, all the astronauts said that was spot on.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I love that kind of detail. There was one shot that really struck me when I watched this again for the second time, was when she is kind of spinning out of control and Clooney is telling her to relax. But she is trying to pull herself together, and the camera kind of comes up to her face mask and then goes inside her face mask, and the sound and everything changes when she, when you get inside. So it's like you're hearing the radio signals from her, and then when you're inside the helmet, you can, she can hear herself. I thought that was so good how they did that. And then they kind of panned around. So now you're looking out of her face mask as she's spinning around and, you know, just pulling herself together. And then she starts to talk coherently to Clooney, you know, like, okay, this is it. And I'm, you know, this is how much oxygen I have and all that. Trying to just rattle off information to get herself to calm down.
Well, and the way they did the transitions was fairly seamless, because when in that sequence, for example, when he's coming up, he's like, okay, flash your light so I can see you. So then you realize, because she could see him suddenly, you could see a little moving dot out there that was him coming. All of a sudden, you've been taken outside of the face mask and you didn't realize it, because then you're watching her flash her lights.
Yeah, yeah.
And they pulled further away, and he's saying, now you can holster your light. Oh, yeah, sorry. You know, which is what she did a lot of. Because, oh, sorry, okay, right. But that, I remember noticing that the first time, the way they would just beautifully change your point of view to be her point of view, to be out. And that really did a lot with, when you don't have a lot of scenery other than the Earth and the stars and whatever few stationary-ish objects there are out there. The other thing was, as you mentioned, the sound. The first time I watched this movie, I came away saying, whoever did this sound, did they do a double Oscar? Because, oh my gosh. Because the thing that really, I noticed it from the beginning, and I don't know why, but I was just like, oh, this is brilliant. Take you in there with her, take you out. But the scene to me that was so striking was when she's in the Soyuz, I guess it is, capsule, and she's hopeless. She's, I can't remember what the moment is, but she's kind of like, Houston in the blind, are you there? You know, and she's stuck, and it pulls out. And so you hear her, because you're there with her, you are her, and then you pull out and it turns into a radio crackle, which is what Houston would be hearing. And you could just see the window getting smaller and smaller. And this is the other thing he did beautifully, is pull away. So you could suddenly say, she is tiny and she's alone in this little bubble out there in this hostile environment. He did that when they were both moving too, Clooney and her with the jetpack, trying to get to the space station or to the Soyuz or wherever they were going. And, you suddenly realize he's pulled out and you're looking at it in the Earth, and you suddenly go, oh my gosh, those two tiny little dots moving. That's them. So yeah, he did a good job of that sense of place. Yeah.
It was really something else. You know, those feelings that he created, the whole, you know, you got the loneliness, right?
Yeah.
And definitely the adversity. You sent me a, interview of him on the treatment.
Yes.
And he talked about loneliness, adversity. And I also saw an interview on Charlie Rose. He and Sandra Bullock. That was really, really very interesting. But yeah, I think it was Rose asked him, you know, well, what was the theme of this movie? And he said, loneliness and adversity. And then Rose said something and then like, and rebirth. And, Karan seemed to make a distinction. He said, and the possibility of rebirth or the creation of the hope that leads to rebirth, I think was what he made that as a distinction between actual rebirth and this. I'm not sure why, but, well, that's what I got out of the movie too. Yeah.
Yeah. Because if it's about adversity and loneliness and striving for something, striving to change things, being jolted out of that and realizing you have that choice.
Yeah. Yeah.
The possibility is there, but you have to grasp it. And that's what she does.
So yeah, the journey is a journey of adversity and then the goal is rebirth.
Yeah. Or yeah, that new beginning.
Right. Exactly.
In that sense.
Which, is a theme that, you know, here in this larger sense, you know, having her in space, you know, it's mostly about Sandra Bullock's character, Ryan Stone.
Right.
And, but that's a lesson for us in our, you know, whatever we're going through in life all the time. And I think that that's a Catholic lesson too. I mean, here we are, approaching Lent, and that's an opportunity for rebirth every single year.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we have our adversities, we have our, you know, the things that we personally go through, and to watch something like this happen and have there be a victory is really inspiring. I expect to watch this movie for the rest of my life, you know, now and then. But I found it very inspiring and, that reason mostly.
And I think it's funny how many people talked about all the deeper elements, but a lot of them didn't really mention the specifically religious elements that were put in the movie. Or one review where I just kind of glanced at it before I saw the movie, and I try not to for a movie like this because I knew I didn't want to know what was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, anybody who's watched, listened this far, I'm just assuming, you know, if you haven't watched it, give it up now. Clooney goes away very early. Let's just get that out there.
Yeah.
But one of the things, because I looked at it and I thought, oh, I didn't expect to see a St. Christopher icon. Oh, I didn't expect to see that little Buddha. And I was like, oh, that's nice. Those reminders. And then comes the big question of, she says, I don't know how to pray. You have that whole sequence where she's sitting there going hopeless. She's lost. She's not even going to try anymore.
Mm-hmm.
She can hear the guy talking in Chinese to his baby and barking with his dogs. And she's saying, will you pray for my soul? And I thought, wow, what an odd thing for anybody to say. And especially when she says, I pray, but no one ever taught me how. And then I thought, where did she then come up with this concept of praying for her soul? And then, of course, she's going to let the oxygen out and go to sleep. And George Clooney shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, I was like, well, now, wait a minute. You couldn't open that and her face not freeze off and all that, you know. And Tom's like, well, the oxygen's going out and all this. So he gets in. All this happens. She wakes up. He's not there. Is it a hallucination? Is it the answer to her prayer?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I think it was an answer to her prayer because she was given important information right there.
Yes.
You know, that she used in order to save herself. And that makes me think that, yeah, there was some reality to it.
Well, and that's what I thought, because to me, and you've had this experience, because I know you're a thoughtful, searching person. When God answers a prayer or speaks to you, even though it looks like something ordinary or explainable on the outside, you know the difference. It's a letter that's been sent to you.
Yeah,
you know?
And
she
often
acts
I don't even realize that until later when I think, you know, wasn't that remarkable? Holy cow, that was remarkable.
Wait a minute.
Yeah, but you're right. You're exactly right. That's it. You know, if I had gone through that experience, there's no way I would have come away from it not thinking that I was helped right there.
Well, and so I'm watching the movie and I'm thinking she's acting completely differently from that moment. She is galvanized. And I thought, well, to me, that means internally she experienced a change that only comes from a little touch of the divine. And I thought, but what in the movie supports this? Is this just my wishful thinking? And then I was reading Father Barron had a transcript of his video commentary on this. And he made a point that I never would have thought of. He goes, at least she takes it to be a link to the transcendent, for she immediately asks Kowalski to communicate her love to her four-year-old daughter who died some years before in a freak accident.
Yeah, that's...
And I went, oh, that's right. She instantly starts talking to him and essentially praying for his intercession.
Hmm.
And I was like, oh, she, that's the clue in the movie.
Yeah, I agree. And it's almost, you know, she's clearly broken up by the death of her daughter. It's affected her life. It's probably why she's in space in the first place. It's like she's just closed off everything. You know, she's like, well, I may as well be in space. I'm alone. You know, and early on, Clooney asks her, you know, what do you like about being up here? And she said the silence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like, I just want to be in a bubble. And that at that moment, it was like she let that go. She saw maybe the possibility or the knowledge that her daughter is somewhere.
Oh, I don't think so.
You don't?
No, because
she acted totally different and now she wanted to live, you know?
Oh, well, no, after George Clooney. I'm sorry. I thought you meant after she said just the silence.
Right. I meant.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I just meant that in, you know, so she felt that way early on. And then at the moment where she was visited when she had given up. I agree with you that her whole attitude, everything was different from that moment forward.
Oh, yeah. No, because I was just thinking about it because beforehand she was terrified and doing the best she could, but she was just reacting to everything around her. And after that moment, she was kind of joyfully proactive.
Yeah.
She was going to step forward. She wasn't going to just react. She was, here's what we're going to do.
And she whatever was, it takes. Yeah, whatever. And whatever happens, happens.
Right.
She was accepting, you know, thy will be done. Let's let her rip, you know.
Ryan, you're going to have to learn to let go was the last thing he says to her.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, and so she's presented with that choice. He goes, I get it. Your daughter died. It's real easy to do this. Mm-hmm. Or you can go forward.
Right, right.
And it made me think of there are all these meanings to gravity. And I know when I talked to Rose right after she saw the movie, she said she liked that. A lot of what happened in the movie was related to gravity, like the fire. If you didn't have a lack of gravity, that fire wouldn't have taken over on the space station that she was on.
Mm-hmm.
The daughter dies because of gravity.
Yeah,
she falls down and hits her head because of gravity. Mm. And somebody was saying in their review, which I hadn't thought of, because, you know, there's also the meaning of gravity, meaning grave or serious. But somebody said the root of the word is the word grave. We're all going to the grave. Now, this may be reaching, but, you know, this was a mainstream movie review. This was on RogerEbert.com by one of the reviewers there. And he says, it's an adjective meaning weighty or glum or substantial, but it's also a noun, the place where we'll all end up eventually. The film is about that moment when you suffered misfortune that seemed unendurable and believed all hope was lost and that you might as well curl up and die, and then you didn't. Why did you decide to keep going? It's a mystery as great as any in physics or astronomy, and one we've all grappled with and transcended.
Hmm. That's nice, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and yeah, as you're talking, I'm thinking, you know, yeah, gravity, and it's like we're all falling towards the same place. As our lives move forward, you know, we're all headed towards the same place.
Oh, yeah.
And that's just an, you know, it's just something, it's almost like a natural law, right?
Right.
We're all falling the same direction.
Right. And it's what kind of struggles do you go through to get there?
Right. That's
fascinating. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it isn't.
Yeah. So you mentioned Rose's, you know, especially when you told me that, you know, the daughter died because of gravity.
Uh-huh.
That clicked something in my head that is kind of a, I don't know, it's an old kind of a science fiction, I guess you could say, argument. You know, is there natural law or is there natural law plus something else? right?
Oh, right.
There's a famous story called The Cold Equations by Tom Godwin.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's a story just about the inevitability or the unforgivingness of natural law. Just in a nutshell, that story is about a guy who's flying a spaceship that is got exactly the amount of fuel he needs to get to where he's going, and he's got a stowaway who weighs just enough to screw up the fuel calculations. So it's like,
and he's taking vaccine to a planet where everyone's going to die.
Right, right.
You know,
exactly.
So he can't go anywhere else. He's got to go there.
Yeah. So now it's like, okay, if he allows her to survive, then he's not going to save these people. And if he does, you know, anyway, that's the conundrum. It's like, you know, these natural laws are not going to be broken. There's nothing that you can do. So you're going to have to make a choice. Mm-hmm. And that's just called the cold equations, you know.
Right.
But, you know, for those of us who believe that there's something else, you know, it's like, I don't know in that story how you could solve that problem. You know what I mean? It's a brutal decision, but gravity.
I think life is full of decisions like that.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't change the laws are the laws. We're here living with these laws.
We are living with these laws, right, right.
You step off a cliff, you're going to fall to the bottom.
Yeah, so I guess my point in bringing it up is that Sandra Bullock, up till this moment, has been experiencing a very cold universe. You know, just scientific cold, things fall, you know, mm-hmm. kind of a universe. And then at that moment of great despair, it's almost like anti-gravity. If you think about the whole thing as gravity, it's just a moment of change, of hopefulness, of knowing that something else could happen.
Yeah,
and never giving up because, you know, until the end, you don't know what's going to happen.
Right. It's that internal shift of the equations are still the same,
mm-hmm.
but how do you attack them? You may live or you may die.
Right. There's always possibilities.
Yeah. And what's, because Star Trek always exists.
Dude, that's so ingrained. I didn't even know where that came from until you said that.
but there are always possibilities, and we think we know what's going to happen, but we don't, because life is unexpected that way. And so.
Right. And that's the thing. There's an unexpected factor that a thing like the cold equations does not take into account. And there is possibilities.
Well, yeah. And even if nothing else, because she would have gone on to the Chinese thing and maybe the exact same thing would have happened. But she knew that somebody out there loved her enough to come and give her what she needed.
Right.
And isn't that often what makes the difference? Does somebody care enough to personally give us the encouragement we need? It doesn't make the job any easier necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
You still have to live within those cold equations. But the difference is love.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what. You look out, think of that universe Quaron showed us. Beautiful, gorgeous. And we've got this life ship called the Earth that we're on. But it's that element, God created all that.
Mm-hmm.
But he still cares about each one of us personally.
Yeah, I recall hearing a lecture one time by Peter Kreeft.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. It may have been the one, If Einstein Had Been a Surfer.
Yeah, yeah, that's good.
But he was talking about how you can view the solar system as, you know, the sun, everything going around the sun, everything holding together. He says gravity is kind of like love. You know, these things all want to be together. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They're always pulling towards each other all the time. And then if you think about that, you know, the whole universe is just this clockwork of love.
Huh.
Yeah. He's out there sometimes, but I sure enjoy his thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah. He's, well, because he's a philosopher, so he can present stuff to you in a way that makes you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes you think about it differently.
Yeah, well, and I know that when I listened to Quaron on the treatment, he was saying that he had a whole nother layer he was going to put in the movie, an intellectual layer.
And that was interesting, yeah.
which made me suddenly look at it and go, oh, it's not simple because he couldn't tell any more of his story. It's simple because he listened to Guillermo del Toro, who said, don't alienate the audience. You have the story. Let them live with the story.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, whoa.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I wonder if he'd, if you imagine, you know, after he said that, I was thinking, okay, well, what did del Toro see there? I would have loved to have read that draft just to see. But what did del Toro see there? I imagine that if these guys are going through something, you know, and then they stop and they give a speech or something like that. I'm not, you know, he's like, no, don't do that. Just do the movie, you know.
Well, there was one thing that when I was looking through some of the information on it, I was telling Tom, I said, okay, well, there's the St. Christopher icon, the statue of Buddha. And Father Barron points out that right after George Clooney's sacrificial act of giving himself up so that Sandra Bullock can live, which he doesn't do in a real obvious way as being sacrificial, but it is, but he's very lighthearted about it, right?
Right.
Or at least acting that way. The next thing he's talking about is it's so beautiful. The sun hitting the Ganges. That's a sacred river to how many people?
Wow.
Then I told that to Tom and Tom says, oh, the movie, the first shot of the earth, you're looking over the Sinai Peninsula where Israel is.
Holy cow.
I know. And I went, I'm pretty sure none of this stuff was by accident.
Bravo. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's when I went, oh, holy moly. That's the exact intellectual thing, I think, argument he was going to discuss is all these elements we're talking about.
Hmm. Yeah, that's neat. That is really cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I just love those details. That's really something.
I know. I never would have thought about it. And I'm like, oh, yeah, the Ganges. Hi. Holiness.
How about that? Yep.
Oh, that was the thing I was going to say that I think, I don't think I got to it, where somebody was talking about the having the Buddha, having the St. Christopher icon. And of course, St. Christopher is the patron saint of travelers. But they were complaining because they said, oh, he dumbed out by not having it just be Christian stuff.
Hmm.
And I'm like, well, let's deny everybody's contact with the transcendent, shall we?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody from the Christian point of view, and especially the Catholic point of view, every religion has a glimmer of the truth.
Hmm.
It's just which one do you find that tells you the whole truth?
Right, right. Yeah, I thought he did it just right. None of it was really heavy-handed either. This is another one of those movies that you can watch and not catch any of this stuff and be perfectly happy. You know,
yeah.
And I think that sure is the way to do that. But I love to find these things in there, and you know, that is awesome. I just love that.
I mean, you work at a movie for 4 years. Those things aren't accidental.
Yeah,
I'm just saying.
That's cool. That's cool.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was really neat.
Yeah, and that is an interesting point, too. Just off the philosophical, you know, taking 4.5 years to make this movie, that was really, that's something else. He said he was 2.5 years developing the technology. Then he shot the movie and then 2 years to put it back together, he said.
Okay.
That's amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. He says, at this rate, you know, my next movie will be 7 years from now.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's too funny.
Well, the other theme that, and this isn't contradictory at all, but somebody was talking about the resilience of life, which of course you mentioned, and evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And it says when she's, you know, at the end, of course, there are so many metaphors there when she's down in the water. Well, first there's the one where she gets onto the Russian spaceship and she's floating in space and it looks like there's a couple of cords coming behind her and that's almost like being in the womb. But then she splashes into the water and she has to swim out and she's been in space so she can hardly stand up and she's been in the water too. So she's not used to gravity anymore. And so, let's see, Quran said she's in these murky waters almost like an amniotic fluid or a primordial soup, in which you see amphibians swimming. She crawls out of the water, not unlike early creatures in evolution, and then she goes on all fours. And after going on all fours, she's a bit curved until she is completely erect. It was the evolution of life in one quick shot.
You know what he didn't mention there that struck me and I actually wrote it down?
What?
When she crawls out of the mud or out of the water and is there, she says, thank you.
Thanks.
Who is she because thanking? Yeah.
She's learned how to pray.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know. Wasn't that great?
It was
she's
great.
She's sitting there just clutching the earth.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know.
So, yeah. I mean, yeah, but that's a neat image too. That whole thing. Yeah. So well done and beautiful. I mean, just so nice looking too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and also that upward shot at the end, you're just seeing her from below. So she can rise above the gravity that was the grave things that were holding her down.
Yeah. And that
they don't control her.
It's almost like anti-gravity for us to stand up, isn't it?
Yeah. I know. You don't think about it because you do it all the time.
Right, right. Yeah. No, heavy she must have felt.
I know.
Yeah. That's amazing. Amazing. Very cool. I love this movie.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at some of the other things I wrote down. I loved in that interview, he was talking about things that kind of influenced him in the movie.
Mm.
There's a movie called A Man Escaped. Have you ever seen that one?
No, but he talked about that in the treatment a lot.
He kept mentioning that. I was thinking, well, what would Joseph Cusanka do? And what he would do is go watch it. So I actually watched it.
Because
it was on Hulu. It's a Criterion one of those Criterion movies.
Okay.
So, yeah. For those of you who don't know who Cusanka is, he's great blog. I love it.
Well, and he was on.
It's always, yeah, he was. He was on our show. But, yeah, I enjoy him quite a bit. And he's always talking about these old movies that he's found and things like that. So, but A Man Escaped is just, it's a French movie. I think it's from 57, if I remember right. I didn't write that down. But it's just about a guy, a Frenchman, who's captured and spends the whole movie plotting an escape. And, you know, you feel for him the whole time, you know, but he's very much alone and trying to find a way out. So that was interesting. And then the other movie that he mentioned is called Marooned. And that's an old one, 70s, I believe.
Okay.
And that was just a movie. He said, you know, it's kind of like the story of Apollo 13, but before Apollo 13 happened or something like that. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And speaking of Apollo 13,
I really
loved the nod to Apollo 13 because the mission control was Ed Harris. That was awesome.
Yes.
If I hear his voice and I'm in space, I know I'm okay.
He was mission control on Apollo 13. Yeah,
that's
I know.
Right.
I thought that was so great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and when I watched it the first time, I came out thinking about Castaway, which is another great movie.
Right, right.
Tom Hanks movie.
Yeah. And that's, you know, it's a tough thing to do a movie that's really centered around one person without many people to talk to.
Yeah.
And, man, this was so good too. Castaway I liked as well.
Oh yeah. I liked that a lot. It's,
But yeah, Sandra Bullock did a really, really good job in this movie. And in that interview with Charlie Rose, she was there with the director, Caron, and they were talking about how she helped flesh the character out as much as she is fleshed out. I mean, there's really not a whole lot of backstory, you know, a little bit. You know, there's just not a whole lot of things going on. You know, you don't see any flashbacks or anything like that.
Right.
But, you know, she added more than was there. She said she didn't know how to play this part without somehow collaborating and making her a little bit more than she was. And the director was all for it, so.
Well, plus she had to do everything with her face, pretty much. What a star turn. I mean, she did an amazing job.
I think so, too. I think she really did a great job with this movie. And she's up for an Oscar for Best Actress, isn't she?
Yeah, she
is. I have no idea
is.
If she'll win. As we record this, I think the Oscars are tomorrow night.
Yes, they are.
I have not watched... I watched some of last year's. Maybe I'll watch some of this year's. Who knows?
We wind up just flipping to it because we forget it's on. Mm-hmm. And then we'll watch some of it and then go, oh, it's already 10:30 and no, not happening.
Yeah, yeah.
But I know that the other movie... I did watch Blue Jasmine a couple of weeks ago because that movie group I was told you about, we've been having our Oscar series as much as we can with movies that are out on DVD so I can get them to their nursing home. But we watched that because it was up for Best Actress. And wow, talk about polarizing. I forget how much people either loathe or love Woody Allen.
Oh, yeah.
I'm more of a lover than a loather on this issue. But some people refuse to watch the movie because they don't like him. I'm like, okay.
Not a fan of the Woody Allen. Yeah.
Well, I know. You know, but anyway, and the person who had watched the movie because Cate Blanchett is up for Best Actress, it said, it's not like one of his usual movies. And I was like, I don't think it was like one of his usual movies. It was really good. It was really different. But anyway, she's up for Best Actress and she was amazing, but I don't know who I'd pick between her and Sandra Bullock. They were both wonderful.
Well, that's good.
Just different, very different roles, you know?
Yeah. 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 Again, I find myself not having seen most of the movies.
Yeah.
That's kind of normal for me.
Captain Phillips, we saw that one too. That one was surprisingly good.
Oh, good.
I spent the whole time in a state of high tension and anxiety.
Wow.
Tom
like this
Hanks
movie.
Yes, but even more so than this movie.
Oh, wow.
More immediate.
I can't
and
imagine.
Tom Hanks
wow.
was amazing. And the last 10 minutes of that movie, he should have been nominated just for that. That
oh,
was
wow.
the most amazing acting I've ever seen anyone do, period.
Holy cow. Well, I must watch that then.
I highly recommend it.
Yeah, so
but
what,
it didn't have the same meaning.
Gotcha. One thing we didn't talk about on Gravity is the complaints about it in the accuracy department. I just think it's fun to talk about because you've got two camps of people, right?
Mm-hmm.
People who, you know, nitpick all the details and, you know, to death. And that's an old science fiction tradition. And then
and then
those who think, you know, or just say, okay, well, it's a fantasy world and, hey, whatever happens goes, it's fine.
Right.
You know, whatever the directors have decided. So I find I'm in between that. I admit fully that when something is, if I'm expected to be in reality, like Gravity,
mm-hmm.
and like this movie, I think that this movie made great pains to be to depict this accurately.
Yeah.
But then when they do something that doesn't make any sense, that annoys me. And it does pull me out of the movie. And I'm like, oh, man, why did they have to do it that way? You know, because that's not right. But I'm at the same time, I can let it go because I am a Star Trek fan. That is an example. You've got to let it go and
yes.
just enjoy the movie. It's like, okay, you know, suspension of disbelief, right?
Right.
So,
right.
But anyway, where do you fall on that? Were you bothered by anything in it?
Well, first you have to know enough to be bothered.
Uh-huh.
I'm just going to say, and I don't. So, but my husband was, he's like you. He would applaud something like this time. What I noticed was that when the Chinese capsule lands, right before it lands on the water, it does this little burst of jets to kind of slow it down, and then it sinks into the water.
Yeah.
And I was like, whoa. And he goes, my husband says, oh, that's because they said it's exactly like the Soyuz capsule, and the Soyuz capsule could land on land, so it had to do that. And I was like, holy crap, that was real. And he's like, yep.
Yeah.
But he would then notice other things like the problems with the George Clooney letting go scene or the thing that really bothered him was the orbit of all those things that she was going to would have been different. And
yeah, that's the main thing,
the movie for him.
Yeah, that's the main thing. It's like the premise of it, the accident itself and the continued occurrence of it.
Mm-hmm.
That was just like, oh, you know.
He also had a problem.
Had to let it go.
I told Tom, and I will tell you, because to me this is not real at all, or it's completely real, is that they were at the perfect equilibrium. They were so light, they weren't being pulled down into the earth. Just going to keep going because they're just at the right spot where they were like the rings of Saturn, which is made up of asteroids and debris.
Well.
Done.
Well, they were at the right equilibrium when they were in orbit. But then if you increase their speed, they're going to go to a higher orbit. and not worry. These guys wouldn't be worried, especially the second time around anyway.
Nope.
Yeah,
nope.
That's
See, obviously I'm not bothered. But I can be bothered because in preparation for our discussion of the Lord of the Rings movies last weekend, I watched The Fellowship of the Ring, and I had to actually just almost hold my mouth shut to keep it from explaining to my husband why Elrond was so screwed up in the movie. I'm all the person I knew from the book. He was a sourpuss.
He was a sourpuss.
Yep.
I love it.
Very unhappy about that.
That makes
so
me happy.
I get it. I really get it. You just kind of have to force your mind away from it. But what I thought was interesting about these arguments about scientific accuracy was some people, I did look this up. I don't know if you did or not. Quran has said it's not a documentary, which I think is the best answer to that whole
thing. And that's really what it is too. You know, it's like, okay, you know, you're right. You know, in this universe that he's made up, you know, everything's fiction. I mean, there's a strong case to be made that everything that we watch and read is fiction, whether it's nonfiction or not, right? Because it's impossible for a piece of fiction to be reality, you know?
Oh, documentaries.
It's like, you know, as if you're trying to explain God and give three examples or something, you know? It's like, you know, there's nothing that you can write. I remember seeing, I forgot who I was talking to. I'm sorry, it's not coming to mind, but that person was saying, you know, you've got to beware of metaphors for God, because every metaphor that you use to try to explain God is limiting God in your mind somehow. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't possibly come up with a perfect metaphor for God or any kind of an explanation, period, to explain God. You know, so everything that you come up with and everything that you write about God is not God.
Well, it's limited. Yeah, it's
limited
just one
because
tiny facet.
And that's the same thing. It is right. So it's the same with reality, right? If you write a nonfiction book about you know, President Reagan or something, that is, in a way, you could say that that's fiction, because there's no way that you can encompass that, right? And how much more is God, right?
Could you write a book about your wife that was completely accurate? I mean,
no, you can't.
No
right.
one can. We couldn't write a book about ourselves because we're always filtering, and that's okay.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's just that's the way it is.
The same way. Documentaries are not impartial.
Right.
Even when they try to be impartial, they have to decide where do they start their impartiality from.
Exactly right.
There's always a point of view.
Exactly right. So in the same way, you know, gravity. You know, it's not going to be 100%. You're going to, you know, they made some choices there, and sometimes you make choices that are going to annoy people. But I still love this movie. I think it's terrific, and that doesn't bother me enough not to enjoy it, because there were such pains taken almost everywhere else. It's you know, I just give them that, you know, you say, okay, that's what's going to happen. And then it's just wonderful after that.
Well, yeah, because in the stuff I found, there was somebody who'd done two Hubble telescope servicing things and a bunch of other stuff. And he'd said there was a one-of-a-kind wire cutter we used on one of my spacewalks. They had that in the movie.
I love that. Buzz, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, Buzz Aldrin said he was impressed by the portrayal of reality of zero gravity. He goes, going through that space station was done just the way I've seen people do it.
Yeah. The tools that they were using, the ones that were, they used to take nuts off or bolts out. NASA had to develop those, because if you take a wrench and you put it on a nut in space and you pull, you're going to go up.
Yeah.
Right? So they had to invent a tool in which, that torquing action is absorbed inside the tool rather than transferred to the user.
Yeah. Okay.
So you put that on there and it's like, you know, very neat. You know, I love that they had that kind of stuff. Those details were cool.
Well, and also some of the stuff that I saw, like some set of scientists said, oh, when he unclips his tether and floats away, this thing is all you'd have had to do to save him. But then other scientists were arguing over it.
Huh.
So there are things that are kind of points that they can't even agree on.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure.
So,
I'd just ask an astronaut who was there, you know. Surely they would have the correct answer. It reminds me of I guess this is a digression, but, you know, all of the arguments that scientists had, you know, before we ever went to the moon or before we ever went in orbit in the first place, how they were trying to describe, you know, this is how it's going to be like, and they didn't really know. And, you know, there was people that thought that when we landed on the moon, we'd just sink because the dust would be so thick that we'd just, you know, you'd be under 20 feet of dust. In fact, Arthur C. Clarke wrote a book about that called A Fall of Moon Dust.
Oh.
Which is about a kind of a little passenger, like a bus on the moon that is on a kind of a cruise. So there's people on the moon and this thing's on a cruise and it's just zipping around. Well, anyway, it loses power and comes to rest on one of the seas. You know, we call them the Sea of This or the Sea of Tranquility or whatever. And immediately sinks under the dust. Oh. And it's a, you know, kind of a Poseidon Adventure
type of a get out.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank goodness. It sounded like a terrible disaster right then and done.
Yeah, that would have been a short book, but that was the beginning.
Oh, right. I was thinking of stories. Yeah. He wrote so many stories. This is a book.
Yeah, it's a novel. A Fall of Moon Dust.
Okay. Yeah. Well, one person, I thought the best comment about all that, the Garrett Reisman, I don't know how to say his name, a former NASA astronaut, said, "Rather than using the medium as a gimmick, gravity uses it to depict a real environment that's completely alien to most people. But the question that most people want me to answer is, how realistic was it? The very fact that the question is being asked so earnestly is a testament to the verisimilitude of the movie. When a bad science fiction movie comes out, no one bothers to ask me if it reminded me of the real thing."
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That what was that last Ridley Scott horror that was perpetrated on the public in the name of the Alien franchise?
Oh, Prometheus. Yeah.
Nobody stopped to ask if that was real. We were all happy. It was just a horrible thing we didn't have to watch again.
Wow. What a swing and a miss that was.
Oh. Yes. That was terrible.
Oh, boy. Yep.
But this was great.
Yes, it was. It was terrific. It was terrific. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you said you're going to watch it again and again. Is it going in the pool room?
It is. Or? It goes in the pool room. I actually bought it. Yeah. I don't buy a lot of movies anymore on DVD. There just seems to be so many other ways to get them. But every now and then there's one, and this is one of them.
Yeah, we were debating that because I had to do the one-night rental. And then I've got to take it to the nursing home where they're going to watch it in various spots around there for a couple of days. So I'm going to pay for 3 days worth. And so we were thinking, is it better to buy it? It turns out it's about even.
Yeah.
We'd lose a little money if we bought it.
Right, right.
We just weren't sure if we'd watch it enough times to make it worth buying it.
Yeah, I'll you know, I have it on Blu-ray. So it's like, you know, we don't have a giant TV. We have pretty good size, but someday... Someday I'll have like a theater in my house or something, you know.
There you go.
Big old screen.
That's a whole wall.
Yeah. And then I'll watch it again. It's, you know, all these different formats they come out with, you know, you end up having to buy movies again and again.
Right. Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Well, and what we've discovered is a lot of the movies that we bought, we don't watch again as often as we thought we would. You know, sometimes there will be movies where you go, oh, my gosh, this hasn't been available in a current format in forever. And so you snatch it up when you see it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you might want that one. But otherwise, you can rent them or stream them or whatever.
Right. Not everything's Star Trek.
Right, right. Or The Castle.
The Castle, right. You know, which I own. That's what I own, The Castle.
Format to format. We keep moving it along.
Yep. Oh, that's too funny.
That and The Wrath of Khan.
Yep. Khan. Another one I own.
Yep.
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 It's too funny.
So I guess that's it for this movie, huh?
I think it is. Yeah. You know, there's not a whole lot to the story part of it. But it really does touch me in that way, in that, you know, spiritual way that you come away thinking, wow, you know, that was profound.
Well, in a sense... You know, Lent does begin next week, and it's almost a good movie to watch if you're in that kind of meditative frame of mind.
Yeah.
And you think about what are the different meanings of the word gravity. Now, he was telling a story. Why did he choose to tell it like this?
I don't know.
I don't know, but I'm just saying that's worth thinking about.
It is. You know, there's one thing that he said in the treatment that I would love to talk just a minute about.
Mm-hmm.
That it was just about cinema. It wasn't about gravity per se.
Yes.
But he said that he felt that cinema is closer to music than it is to literature or theater.
I loved that when he said
that. I did too. That was a really, you know, I hadn't really thought of it that way, but he's, I did enjoy how he was talking about how the language of cinema, you know, that's why he said, you know, A Man Escaped, you know, he said, I use this from A Man Escaped. It's almost as if he sees all of cinema as people talking to each other. And then in Gravity to use some kind of a scene where it's from A Man Escaped, let's say, that's him talking back. It's like a conversation. Mm-hmm. And I like that very much. And I like seeing things like that in movies where I'm like, oh, that reminds me of this movie. Mm-hmm. There's something really satisfying about that, something enjoyable about that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just like in science fiction, especially in the early days, not so much nowadays, but in the early days where someone would write a story and someone else would write a response to that story.
Right.
You know, some philosophical point that they made. Well, rather than write a letter, they'd write another story, you know, and it would go in the same magazine or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so all of cinema is kind of that way. And I like how he looked at it that way. And then, you know, as far as it being closer to music than it is literature or theater, I think that there's a lot of movies that I kind of feel that way about without having ever put it that way, where you watch it the same way, you know, that's why a movie is rewatchable, you know, whereas books are not usually rereadable. Some of them are, right?
Almost all of them are.
You think so?
For me.
Yeah, I don't reread a lot. I reread some.
My husband doesn't either.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
But I reread a lot. But there are short stories that strike me as in a kind of a musical way. You know, there are some things I have on my iPod that are fiction that I have on my iPod permanently. You know, like this thing never comes off my iPod. You know?
Interesting.
Yeah, and the Star read by Arthur C. Clarke is one of those.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, and I would say that audio versus regular reading, for me, are ways to open a book up more if the narrator is right. Sometimes I have a book so firmly in mind that I can't make that transition. But it's the thing we were talking about on The Lord of the Rings where, you know, the audio does this for you and it allows you to appreciate the text, and then you read the text and you can appreciate the audio more. They work together.
Yeah.
But I liked the idea of the movie being like music because it's engaging more than one sense, for one thing, and it's kind of flooding over you and immersing you. And so you're taking it in and thinking about it and experiencing it in a different way than a book. That's all to me.
True. I agree with that 100%.
And I'm just now listening to that. What is that class called? How to listen to and understand great music or whatever. Robert Greenberg from I can't remember the name of it, but it's one of these things where it's like got 1,000 parts to it, but he takes you through from the beginning of music to now, I guess. And he has just now finished the second part of going through Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. And I was like, oh my gosh, now I have to sit down and listen to that a bunch of times because I now understand Beethoven was talking about life versus death versus all these things in here. I just thought it was a great song. Because I never thought about that kind of music that way. I'm completely untutored in that.
Yeah, and I am too. Yeah.
And so Cuarón saying that makes me go, oh, right, you have to have somebody to kind of lead you in. But when you get it and it immerses you, there's so many layers and levels to it. And that's the same thing here.
Yeah.
It's like Pan's Labyrinth, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah, Pan's Labyrinth, the first time I saw that, it was, you know, I liked it. And then when I see it in order to talk about it, I watch it differently and I may look at some things, you know, maybe listen to a director's commentary or something. And that movie was enhanced by that, you know, I can think of movies that would not be enhanced by that, but you know, yes. Same with music too, right? But, this movie, the more I've learned about gravity, the more I've liked this movie.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly.
Right. So,
well, I can't believe you don't reread very much.
I don't reread often at all. You know, the books that we tend to talk about are mm-hmm. definitely rereadable books. You know, often if we're going to talk, if I pick a book that I've read, I always reread it for the podcast.
Right. Me
and
too.
Those are that's the most rereading I've ever done. I mean, there before that, there was a very small number of books I had ever reread.
Has it been rewarding to you to
yes,
reread those books?
It has been.
Yeah.
Yep. But I don't know that it would. I don't know that I'd feel that way about everything.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there are times, you know, when I've reread a book with great hope, thinking, you know, boy, I sure enjoyed this when I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to be wonderful. And then I pick it up and I read it and I'm like, oh, boy, that was really kind of not very good.
Well,
you know,
because
we do change.
That just shows the different taste and the mm-hmm. place you were at then.
Sure. Yeah.
We all have the things we learn versus the things that we achieve later, and that goes for reading. But then mm-hmm. also there are books where you pick them up and you go, well, kind of like The Lord of the Rings again, where you go, wow, I did not understand this 20 years ago. Yeah, I wasn't old enough to understand
exactly
it.
What happened with Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Now I have a companion for the rest of my life. Yeah, and Jane, you know, that's what I'm saying. You know, the books that we tend to select are that type of book. I would say.
I've got so many of those kind of books out there. Although I have mm-hmm. a few that are just fun for one-offs that I was like, but I want to talk about some of the things in the book, and I may find things in them when I'm rereading them that I didn't notice because I tend to be such a fast reader, as I've said,
mm-hmm.
that I'll miss things the first time through. Sometimes not.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that I miss things too. You know, I'm not a very fast reader at all, but when I have reread, it has... As long as, you know, there's things in the book that are meaningful, you know, it does enhance it. So.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the way with the movies, you know, like you're saying. In fact, you've just solidified the movie that I'm going to pick next because I was looking through my list.
Nifty.
I mean, we've got a ways to go before mm-hmm. then. But I was just going, oh, man. And there are some movies that in our house, this will be when we watch this movie, I'll watch it. To talk about it, and mm-hmm. it'll probably be the seventh or eighth time I've watched this movie.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
That's
such
exciting.
Yeah.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Well, I hope you win an Oscar tomorrow night.
Good luck. Good luck, Gravity. I guess by the time this comes out, everyone will know.
Yeah, that's right. Everyone will know.
But they'll know why they should watch this, whether
that's
or
right.
not it's an Oscar.
That's right.
Because let's face it, 12 Years a Slave is going to be the popular one to vote for because it's a cause movie.
Ah, okay.
Or the Dallas Buyers Club, it's also a cause movie, but mm-hmm. not such a current cause or, you know, overriding cause as 12 Years a Slave. Yeah. So,
will Matthew McConaughey win Best Actor? I have not seen that movie, so I shouldn't say
that.
I know he's one of your favorites.
I've heard Yeah, the depth, you know. Well, of course, I haven't seen him in roles that call for depth. But, I understand that's a very tough movie to watch. And so I will not be watching that movie mm-hmm. unless forced to by you or the podcast.
I have not seen the movie. So.
Oh, thank goodness.
Mm-hmm. That's one in the list of movies I have not seen or the Oscar winner or nominees.
Yeah. So. Well, we have movies coming up next time too, right?
Yes, we do. We are going to complete our discussion of Lord of the Rings by talking about the movies because I think that'll be fun.
Yep.
And I did select the next book, which is going to be April 3rd, it looks like. We'll talk about Good Omens by Pratchett and Gaiman.
Fantastic book.
Yeah, it's going to be fun.
So funny and so much to talk about.
You bet. This will be a fun book to read again.
A fun book about the apocalypse. Woohoo!
Yes, all right.
And then I have chosen the movie to come after that. As I said just now, it's a Chinese movie.
Uh-huh.
It's called Shower. And is about a bathhouse in Beijing.
Excellent. I know nothing about that. That'll be fun.
Yeah. And then... What did I pick? Oh, The Rosie Project.
Good. Okay. I've got that in my possession. Because you said, I'm going to pick this. Go get it.
Yeah.
It was like $2 on Kindle or something like that. Go grab it. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so, it was a good thing I did because it's such a great book. And I've now come across two or three other great books since then. So would have gotten shoved out of the way possibly. But I made that commitment. So
too many good stories. Too many good ones. That's great.
I guess a good story is not hard to find, as we've said before.
I love it. You bet. All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody.
Yes,
and
it's been fun.
Yeah, we'll see you in a couple weeks for Lord of the Rings.
Yep. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.